Well, why don't we begin? It's 10:05 by my courtroom clock, and I'd like to call the meeting to order. I suggested to Sarah that for purposes of Zoom meeting, I don't know that it's necessary that we have roll call, but when we come back to meet in person, we'll resume that because everybody can see each other's names and we have a good idea who's present. I did see that Cynthia Mauser was present and then had left, so I'll try to make a notation when she comes back. I do want to pay a compliment to DRC and irrespective, I mean, it has something to do with Sentencing Commission, and I wanted to make sure that she was able to hear it.
I think she's in the attendee portion of
the meeting. Oh, is she? Okay,
right now,
and I see that.
Yeah.
Well, with the privilege of being vice chair, then let me first offer a special recognition to DRC and particularly Mary Oakley from the Bureau of Sentence Computation and Bridget Slayton from their PRC division. One of the things that I would like the Sentencing Commission to have a voice in addressing down the road is seeing if we can simplify PRC in terms of judicial implementation of penalties. I've had a case that is extremely complicated because of an individual who has mandatory sentences and he committed multiple county offenses, I mean, multiple offenses in different counties. And I've been on the phone trying to sort out application of sentencing law. And, you know, I know there are times where judges and officials from DRC don't always see eye to eye, but I can't tell you how grateful I've been to the members of DRC staff, particularly Mary Oakley and Bridget Slayton, in trying to help me navigate through the complex sentencing scheme. And I just don't think that we recognize the efforts that our disciplines make when interacting. We're always in a more adversarial role at times than a collegial role. And I know that we always want to get it right. And the fact that we have all these disciplines together give me the opportunity, and I want to take advantage of it to thank DRC and their staff members for helping me navigate. Now, they still may disagree with my conclusions, but at least we had a good journey getting there. So with that said, December 17th meeting minutes were previously emailed to you. Does anyone have any corrections or additions or deletions they want to make?
Move to approve the minutes, Spanigal.
All right, is there a second?
Second, Judge Fregali.
Although any more discussion? All those in favor, raise their hand or say aye. All opposed, same sign. All right, they're approved. Chief Justice O'Connor is with us as chairman of the commission. I didn't know, Justice O'Connor, if you wish to say anything before we begin our agenda.
No, I don't, except maybe I do sympathize with you, Judge, on the complexities of sentencing and the nuances of mandatory versus discretionary versus who knows what. My understanding is that there's a movement in the legislature to maybe clarify and streamline a lot of our criminal code. So I guess the only thing I can say is stay tuned. I don't know what's going to be, you know, where they are in that process, but you're not alone in your observations and the challenges that you have faced as a result of what some would say an unnecessarily complex scheduling, sentencing schedules and overlapping, conflicting, incompatible, you know, you name it. It's a challenge for the trial judge.
Thank you, Chief. And I would encourage, and as I have encouraged some of my colleagues at the trial level, to reach out to DRC officials and see if we can work through some of the complexities. So with that then said, let's turn to the agenda. We have a presentation of Sentencing Data Platform, and we have some distinguished presenters today. And I'm going to let Judge Zmuda take the control of the steering wheel temporarily, Judge, and make sure you give your colleagues the opportunity to speak. Judge Zmuda?
Yes, I know. They're going to do most of the talking, actually. I just want to lay the groundwork. And to that end, thank you for allowing me the opportunity to present once again to this august group. It's interesting you're talking about the complexity of sentencings. That's really what started us on this path for the data platform. As you know, this group, the commission authorized an ad hoc committee to create a standardized judgment entry for felony sentencings. A lot of that had to do with simplification, or at least the elimination of unforced errors, as I call them, in the sentencing on felony cases. That work was completed. The sentencing entry is now being vetted throughout the state by judges of the court. And we are now looking at the consequence of that, which is being able to use that document and the documents associated with that to create, for the first time in Ohio, a statewide sentencing data platform. Much work has been done in this effort since the last time this commission has met. I just want to point out in the materials that you have been sent documents that are well worth your perusal. I won't go through them other than to highlight what they are and stand for. The first is the schematic diagram. It shows the organizational structure. This is a key point because it shows that the depth and breadth by which we have created organizations and entities to help manage the creation of the platform and then its governance when the platform itself is up and running. In terms of the creation of the data platform, two other documents that are well worth your time and attention that we've generated. The first is the Ohio Sentencing Data Platform Goals and Uses. I think this is a nice two-page summary which gives you the perspective as to how it is that we're trying to accomplish the creation of this data platform. And then the second is a sentencing database background and path forward, which gives a little more specificity, but still is a nice two-page summary of much of our efforts and goals and the kind of the guiding principles that are governing our operation in the creation and managing of this data platform. So since we last met, we've actually undertaken, and you know, we have the University of Cincinnati engaged in the creation of this platform that has resulted in their going out actually to the one volunteer court, and that's Judge Reed. And so what we thought we would do right now is we would allow Judge Reed to present to all of you about the experience he's had in using the use, and more importantly, in having the experts of IT at the University of Cincinnati to come out and talk about the practical reality of creating this web-based data platform using the use. So, Judge Reed.
Thank you, and thank the entire commission for allowing me to present. I was part of the ad hoc committee that Judge Zmuda just talked about in formulating the use form, and I would concur and echo his thoughts that our goal in that formulating the uniform sentencing entry was to try to not only standardize the process, but maybe simplify, and like he said, to try to avoid some unforced errors. So I understand, Judge Salvaggio, with the complexities that we're faced on the trial bench. I think in my experience with the use form, while it probably isn't going to get rid of all of the issues, because cases can sometimes get more complex than we can believe, and with multiple counties involved, but I think the use form is a great, not just because I was on it, but on the committee that made it, but I think it's just a good form to go through. It points out all the different issues that we need to look at when we're sentencing, the simplest F5 to the most complex indefinite felony of the first or second degree, multiple counts and all of that. It's just almost like a treatise. in terms of what it offers and the guidance it offers. So I started using the use form in September of 2020. Shortly before that, I believe it was in August, after we had created the first iteration of the use form, I was asked to, if I would be the pilot program for the data collection project. And I think maybe Allen County was chosen, maybe because I was on the ad hoc committee that made up the use form, but we're a medium-sized county. We're a two-judge court, but we have all of the problems of some of the bigger counties in terms of the criminal cases that we see, but we're not too big that I don't think it would be too much to try to use a bigger county as a pilot county. Allen County is a good size. And so I took on the challenge to be the pilot, kind of not really knowing what I was getting myself into at the time, but it's just been 100% from the get-go a good experience. The use of the USE form, the use form, took a little getting used to for me and my staff, because it was different than what we were doing before. But I, as I started using the use form and knew I was going to be on the pilot court for the data collection, I started seeing how this use form, among other things, is going to be very helpful in gathering the data that we need. Throughout this whole process, I talked to other judges and I thought about it myself. And of course, I'm on the committees and I've heard from all the experts, and I've convinced myself that collection of the data is a good thing. It's a thing that needs to be done, not just for transparency, not just for efficiency, but I think, as I've stated before, I think if you look at our obligations as judges and the canons of judicial conduct to try to improve the system, to try to dispel any misconceptions or misperceptions about what we do in sentencing, I can't think of a good argument why we wouldn't want to collect data. So I bought into it from the get-go, and my mind hasn't been changed. We met, I've been on the committees, the work committee, from the beginning, but we finally met in December with Hazem and his team from Cincinnati. They came to Allen County. They sat through one of my sentencing hearings. So what we thought might be a half hour or an hour meeting turned out to be the entire morning of about 4 hours, where Hazem and his team probably asked more questions of us in the judicial system than we asked of him from the technical standpoint. He met with me, he met with my court staff, my court reporter, my probation officers, my clerk of courts, and just was thorough in the questions that they asked. And again, that gave me an assurance that the technical people want to know about our process so they can develop the right programs, what we need in terms of this. And we're learning a lot as we go along. We know all of the data that needs to be collected isn't going to come necessarily from just the use form, but we'll have the probation departments involved where there's a lot of data gathered. The clerk's office is the initial point where data is started with the filing of an indictment. The judge, the court reporter, law enforcement, all of these parts kind of come together at a sentencing hearing, and all the information that I have and all of us judges have in a pre-sentence investigation, or statements by attorneys, statements by the defendants, all of that stuff, if we can figure out ways to record that and then put it into a platform that can be mined later on by individuals that were interested in that. So the December meeting was great. And so Hazem and his team got hard at work. I went about my business continuing to use the use form. The use form is a work in progress. It's always being revised and added to. And I try to keep up to date on that. And then we've got kept in touch with Hazem and his team, and they're coming in April. And I'm looking forward to, I'm excited. My staff, nervously excited about the kind of the initial test launch, if you will, of this platform. And I know Hazem's going to talk a little bit more about that after I do, but it's amazing how quickly the technology team has put this together. My job so far, knock on wood, hasn't changed that much in terms of what I do. I hope that I'll be a part of the data gathering. I don't see that at this point as making me do more work than I already do. I think in the end, Ron, it's going to make it more efficient, and we're just happy to be a part of it. I'd be glad to answer any questions, but I just I can't stress enough that I think this is important for the improvement of our system, for the transparency of our system, to answer, quite honestly, to answer criticisms, whether they're valid or invalid criticisms. That's one thing I've talked to other judges about. They're going to say, well, they're going to gather this information and somebody's going to twist it and turn it and use it against us. And I'm trying to tell everybody, don't be afraid of that. I mean, facts are the facts, and sure, things can be spun, but things are being spun now, and there's a lot of misinformation out there. So I think it's important to address any misperceptions or misinformation, and the only way to address that is with cold, hard facts and data. So if I can be a part of providing that, I'm happy to do that. So that's all I have to say. I'll answer any questions or turn it over to either you, Judge Zemuda, or to Hazem to continue.
Any questions for Judge Reed? Seeing none, then before I introduce Professor Saeed, I want to stress two principles that override our effort here. The first is this has grown organically. All right, and that is at the chief's direction and as we've met. And what I mean by that is that this isn't something that is going to be dictated from on high down to the courts, but rather allowing the courts to understand the process, to see how it can improve the operation of the court, much like Judge Reed has said. So it has grown exponentially within the trial courts. It also will help refine that use document that we created in the ad hoc committee to make sure that we got it right. Because that use document will eliminate, I think, all of the errors if used appropriately. The other thing is our engagement with Dr. Saeed and UC is premised on a principle that we're not allowing the technology to change the practice that exists in the trial courts, but rather to say, how can we use technology to augment or to help the practice of how judges impose sentence in your respective courts? I'm well aware, having been a former trial judge, the breadth of differences in how various courts handle felony sentences. And the important thing is to create a mechanism, to say, can technology create a tool, a web-based tool that can help improve that operation without dictating you have to change your operation? Because it seems to me that you lose the effectiveness of that. And Hazem has continued to assure us from day one that is something that can be achievable and has designed his team in moving forward with what you're about to see with that goal in mind. So with that, I'd like to introduce Professor Saeed, who can take over and give us a demonstration of a little window of what we can expect when this is up and running. Dr. Saeed?
Thank you, Judge Zemuda. Good morning, everyone. If you allow me, I will share my screen.
You should be able to, Hazem.
Yes. And I'll be sharing multiple applications. So my goal is to give you an overview of the process, and then I will switch to show you where we are in the application itself at this time. We call this process, or this stage we are in, discovery phase, which is a part of a roadmap. It was about a year ago when we first interacted with Sarah and the team and quickly recognized the complexity of this project. And the complexity lies in the diversity of the stakeholders and the importance of, as Judge Zemuda mentioned, to stay true to the stakeholders' current processes and not to be disruptive. So we designed a roadmap. We figured this is not a one-time thing. It has to be evolving and continue in an incremental approach. So we designed a preliminary roadmap that has three steps: design, build, and advance. And in each one, it goes into phases. So we thought that at the first step, we need to kick off and understand the lay of the land, if you could say, and identify the types of technology that we need to put together. And once we do that, we continue to launch that technology and advance to different spaces. In the incremental approach methodology, we start with what we know and develop the next phases as we go along. So we originally started with what we later called discovery phase as a sub-element of what we identified as a kickoff. And quickly, due to the governance structure that Judge Zamuda hinted to and the visit that we had with Judge Reed, we found opportunities to advance. So when we started originally back in September or October, our ultimate goal for this year, ending end of June, is to define what data elements need to be there, identify the users, and develop a pilot system that we can softly test and evaluate. However, once during the fall semester, from September all the way to December, the momentum generated by the governing process, by the use form, by the different conversations with the judges, by the visit to Judge Reed, and also by a couple of conversations with the chief, we thought that perhaps we can advance quickly. When we visited Judge Reed, and thanks to him and his staff, they helped us understand how to seamlessly integrate the use form into existing practice, we were able to identify a six-step process. The process starts from the court management system, the existing system, and pulls simplified set of data out of that system and manually update that into our system. So this is the step where we intersect with the existing process by pulling some data from the court management system. Then the steps after that is our system will provide a platform to develop the sentencing entry. So as the judge and the staff discover information that goes into the entry, they can use our system, which is built around the use form, to develop that sentencing entry. And once it is developed and finalized, they can take it out of our system as a Word document and continue their existing practice where they upload that sentence entry, they sign it and upload it. But through this small intersection, we are able to capture the data related to the sentencing entry in a comprehensive manner that allow us to identify the story behind the sentence from all its different dimensions, and the system can then provide the staff. So the opportunity that came at the beginning of the year is to, can we accelerate that discovery phase by developing the system as a product and rolling it out to a handful of courts? Can we engage more courts beyond just Allen County? And can we actually, once we engage with these courts, can we roll out the system to them as well? So instead of reaching June and we only have a pilot, we reach June and we have a system that is deployed in several courts. We were able to work out the timeline to support this update. So our current goal is to have what we call a version one of the system. Remember, we're following incremental approach. So breaking down the large objective into smaller objectives and develop those smaller objectives and keep growing with time through a roadmap. So we started visiting other courts. In fact, in March, we visited Lawrence County. We're going to Highland County in April, and we already identified several counties for May and June, and we even got beyond June as well. As Judge Reed mentioned, we're visiting his court on the 16th, but prior to that, we'll be having virtual conversation with him to show him the system and get him comfortable with what the system will do. And our goal is to, after the successful launch with Judge Reed's court in May and June, we roll out to the other courts that we visited as well. As we go through this, we gained better understanding of the challenge of developing a statewide sentencing data and all the various stakeholders associated with this project. So I updated the roadmap to use a circle to indicate continuous improvement. In any sub-objective, we need to learn to start by learning about the different dimensions of that objective, design the technology to seamlessly integrate with existing processes, build that technology, then pilot it, and finally deploy it. And then if you, this is two-dimensional, but if you think that this is a first step, then think of another step where we go through that, because every time we deploy it, we learn something new and the process starts again. So the roadmap starts with discovery, which we're hoping to end this June. But then after that, we continually throughout the process, improving on that system, developing additional versions that expand the system, both through better intelligence and identification of the law and the code, through providing a stronger access to the data that informs the courts and the public, through integration with other systems that support different steps of the criminal justice process. And that helps us to develop the story of sentencing in Ohio. Then we continue to scale the data by adding more and more data elements, scaling through the different courts and understanding the different dynamics that happens and recognizing the strength of the locality and each community, and continually going through improvement to achieve the ultimate goal, which is having an impact. We envision after this discovery phase that this roadmap can take somewhere between 2 to 5 years, depending on what we do. So where we are right now, I will leave the PowerPoint and switch to my desktop to show you where the application is at this time. Judge Reed, this is the first time he sees it. So hopefully it will be easygoing. So I'm showing now an Excel file. This is a sample Excel file that we will able to extract from the court management system, CourtView. As you probably know, there are many different types of reports that we can extract from the court management system. We settled on this one because it's very simple. It only gives us the case number, the date, the party, the status, and the judge. We believe that every court management system will have this report, and such at this initial stage, we will not have any issue integrating with an existing court management system. Once we pull that information out, and I entered some information here, all mock-up information, we go to the system. Once we log in into the system, we are presented by a dashboard. The dashboard provides different types of data. Now, I want to preface this and say that there is, I believe, several working groups and governing structure that are trying to decide what should go in here. At this time, we use the data that comes out of the aggregate annual report in Allen County Court. Judge Reed gave us an example of that. So we use the data element that they show to build this dashboard, but this dashboard is for demonstration purposes only. We can make this display whatever the governance structure decides is appropriate. This is meant to show, once you sign in as a judge or as a court staff, what is more important for you to do today. And that's what a dashboard is about. You could see on the left side, there's a large area. This is meant to provide functionalities. At this time, there are only three functionalities. The first one is this dashboard. The second one is uploading the case, which uploads that Excel file into our system. And that's how we achieve that integration with existing court management systems. And the third functionality is access to each one of those case entries. However, as you can see here, we have a lot of space for additional functionalities. And that's what I meant by incremental approach that we're going to keep adding and building as we go. In addition, you can see on the top, we have capabilities to push notifications, to build messaging, to build what we call individualized approach to the user. One of the important elements in a system like this is whoever will use the system need to be comfortable with it. So maybe these features are not directly related to the sentencing objective, but they are important to keep the user engaged because the user is the one who will enter the data. So if the user is happy and engaged and believing in the system, they will enter accurate data, and thus it will improve the entire process as well. And there is additional space on the top for us to add different things. I'm going to demonstrate the six steps that I identified earlier. And just as a reminder, I'm going to switch to my PowerPoint to just show these steps again. So the first step is to extract this file from the court management system. We envision one of the staff will do that as they prepare the docket for the court. So they got that file out of the system. Then the second step is to upload that into our system. So I'm going to go and show how this will be done. So the staff will go to the functionality called upload cases. And in that functionality, they will click on this button and will able to find the file that they downloaded from the court management system and select open and submit that file. And then they will get a notification that the file is submitted. So that is a step number two. That's all what the staff will need to do. After this step, all the cases that came out of the court management system is now available in our system. So we can go to the list of entries. And in the list of entries, I'm going to go to page two. So these are the two cases that I just uploaded. So you can see the two cases are here, uploaded with the case number, the defendant information, and the judge that it was assigned to. And then it gives here the status, which is draft. So the sentence entry is in draft until the judge finalizes it. And during that time, there are two options that can be done. First, update the case information. Then the second one is update the sentence entry. Update the case information is for us to collect all the data that Judge Zamuda was referring to that may not be part of the use, but very important to help us develop the story behind the sentence. So the information we uploaded from the case management system is here. But as you know, the court receives the indictment and the case file, which includes information other than that, most important, the charges, what are the counts, the offense codes, the names, and so on, and enters information on prosecutors. So I'm just going to make some selections here. There are buttons here to update that information if needed. And as you can see, the technology we developed allow us to enter many. So if you want to enter another one, you just do that. And that allow us to enter more than one candidate for each one of those elements. To add the charges from the indictment, clicking the add and then the offense code, you just type the code and the system will filter the code as you type it. And I want to mention that the list here is a made up list. So we made it up as technology people. There is a discussion currently ongoing to trying to create an Excel file that has accurate representation of those between what existing in the court management system and the standard that we are hopeful for. So I know some of these are not accurate. Some of these don't look right to you. So please don't criticize that list. It is just a made up list for now. But once I selected a code, notice that the system will automatically recognize the name and will display that name right here. One of the things that we added in this system is you can associate more than one offense code with each count. and it works in similar technology. So I already entered one code. If the indictment has another code, then I just click and select another code. And I'm probably going to select things that are unrelated. So please apologize. This may not be an actual case. I don't know much about the law. But you can also come here and select from the actual name. And if I select actual name, the system associates the right code with that name. So between these two, the court staff will build the offenses that are associated with the count. If there is another count, they just click add and have another count and build another associated one. At this time, they need to select the offense level manually. And if there are specifications, they can add those specifications as well. If they made a mistake, they can remove it. Again, this is the reading from the indictment document. So if they made a mistake in one of those, I just delete it. So it is removed. And I probably should have selected this one instead. We don't expect this to happen, but at least in this initial release, if they realize that they were looking at the wrong indictment document for this particular case and they want to remove these and enter something else, you know there is a lot of human errors, so they can just use these buttons to remove and enter again. Once it is done, we update. So now the case is updated. Once the case goes into the sentencing phase, they can come, the judge or the staff, and click on update sentence entry, and you will notice it already has the information that we just entered, so the counts that we added from the indictment loads into the sentence entry directly, and it is ready with the format that exists in the use form. So I have the information about the plaintiff, and I can add the date, so maybe they appeared in front of the judge today. You can select if the defender was present. One of the things, and I will probably stop here, I'm not gonna go through the entire form, but I will just demonstrate that anytime the input data in the form is pre-known is made out of a list, we provided that list. So the staff or the judge doesn't have to enter he was present, they just select the present and it is added. And this is the kind of the approach that we provided so far. In addition, we used checkboxes because the use form has a lot of sections. So the sections are hidden until you say, I'm gonna have merger of offenses. So once you do that, you select merger of offenses, it opens up the details of that section. So if there is something, then I can add that and it provides all the information for the staff or the judge. We know that every judge handles this differently. The Judge Reed, if you don't mind, in Judge Reed's example, he prepares the sentence entry before he goes to, so he starts filling the things that he already knows. So this will allow him to do that. The system automatically saves. So how long can this happen? It can actually happen at any time. So I can go back to the list of entries. So I left that entry. Everything I entered and changed actually saved automatically. So let's say this was a day where we just wanted to put schedule the sentence. So we put the date in there and leave. Then we come a week later and we need to enter additional information. So we come and open, everything I entered is there. And I continue doing it. At the end of the process, the judge can finalize, or the staff, if the judge says already it's all finalized, they click finalize. And once they click finalize, they have the option to extract the selections they made in the sentence entry through the use format into a Word document. So if I click on that, the system will ask me, you have a Word document. So I open the Word document. And the Word document is not fully complete, but it is still work in progress. It uses the format in the use form with the information that is entered and selected already populated. The reason we went with Word document at this time is to give more flexibility to the judge and the court in case they need to add information or adjust information, they can still edit this. We envision over the period of the roadmap, there will be a lot of continuous improvement, as the judges come and say, hey, I always use this paragraph. It goes back to the use committee and the use committee may say, yeah, let's add that paragraph. So it's going to be a continuous improvement process. And we think that eventually we might even be able to provide different types of templates so that judges who want to use something different. Now that the judges has a document, we are back to the current process. Because currently, they use a Word document to build their own sentence entry. They print it, they sign it, and file it in the court management system. So our system gives them back that document. So in other words, our system is a sentence entry preparation system. So you can think of it, it's not really a data platform. It's a preparation system for the entry, and then the data is secondary. And once we do that, we have the data, and the data becomes available. I will stop here and stop sharing, and back to you, Judge Zimmel.
Thank you very much, Professor Saeed. Any questions? Judge McIntosh.
Yeah, thank you. And I don't know if this is a question for Judge Reed, for Judge Samuda, or Saeed, but at what point in the process are you recommending or suggesting that the information and the data gets input into the form at the point in which the judge is sentencing?
The data is inputted, depending on the nature of the data, is inputted at various stages of that six-stage process, Steve, all right? So the initial stage would be the integration of the data that the clerk's office typically has available on any given case to create the file, create the party's names, hopefully the parameters of the charges. Depending on the ability of integrating of data with the prosecutor's office, the more integration that the clerk's office has, the easier it will be to integrate into this use document, all right? And then as the plea is completed and as the court prepares a sentence, you're preparing the documents and therefore you're adding additional data points at that level as well. This is only dealing with the use. There was one screen that you saw a reference to a use/MOC. That wasn't the chief's use form, but rather MOC designates method of conviction, which is another document that was created by the ad hoc committee that isn't part of this initial discovery phase, but is anticipated would join us and be part of this process in the next or subsequent phase. So it's just another source for data. Or Jeff?
Yeah, Gene, thanks. That was a great question. This is the first time I've seen this, and it's just amazing what they've done. Everything is already being done by a clerk or court staff or a judge now, but this is going to put it all into one place. Every judge I know does things differently. Now, as Hazem said, and they learned, when I'm preparing for a sentence, I now have a template, so to speak, and I entered in by hand as I'm going through pre-sentence investigations. I'm making notes to myself on things that I know have to be in that entry. I'm starting to think about merger. I'm starting to think, are there mandatory sentences? I'm starting to think if there are multiple counts. What determinations do I have to make as I'm reading through the PSI or if I've watched the jury trial, I know this information. So I'm starting to fill these things out before I have the sentencing hearing. And as it's explained, as it's been shown here, I'll still be doing the same thing. Actually, it's going to make things easier because a lot of the information that I'm filling out on my little form and my little notes is already going to be there because the clerk's office or a staff person has already put that in there. It's amazing. I mean, when you use the use form, a lot of adjusting is getting in, putting in the code section and putting in the name of the offense and all of that and squeezing it into this little bunch of little lines on the paper. This process is doing all that for you. All you're going to have to do then is really get down to the thought process of sentencing. So, but for me personally, I'm going to be entering a lot of this data before I go to the sentencing hearing. When I make my sentencing determination at the sentencing, I don't have a computer at the bench. I'm not going to be putting things in as I'm talking at a sentencing hearing. but my staff will be taking notes. What is the sentence? What were the findings that I made to make this a consecutive sentence? Things like that, they'll have those. And then after the sentencing hearing, we can finalize it, and presto, we're going to have our entry. I think just watching this here, it's going to be make it more efficient for what I, than what I do. Now, every judge in the state, maybe in the big counties, they're not doing the filling out the forms by themselves like I do, but so what? If you're having a staff person do it in preparation of a sentencing hearing, the staff person will be entering the data for you. So I'm amazed at what they've done. It's how they've captured the process into a computer program that is just going to pop things out automatically. It's really impressive.
And I just want to add something to that question from a technology. The reason we have a draft state of the form and a finalize button is we realize every court will engage in the sentence entry at different times in the process, and the system will not impose or attempt to impose a particular steps for the court. The court can use it whenever they currently engage in a sentence entry. This could be a one-time thing, as some courts do after the entry, after the sentencing hearing, they prepare the entry, the system will allow that. And all of these six steps can happen within 1 hour after the sentencing hearing. Or some courts engage at a multiple process while they're preparing, then during, then after, the system will also allow that. The system is not going to impose particular times.
And if I may, I like that part of that too, because I'm always, and I've always traditionally review all the 29.12 sentencing guidance factors during my sentencing hearing. So I'm verbalizing at my sentencing hearing kind of my thought process. What are the more serious factors? What are the less serious factors? What are the recidivism factors? That's not in the use form. There's mention that we've considered all the factors in the use form, but I actually check them off on my little cheat sheet as I'm going through it. So I think what we could do, if a judge wants to put that in his written final entry, the way this is set up, we could add that in later, or perhaps make it, you know, in our template, so to speak, for our use. So it just seems like this is very flexible, very user-friendly. I'm a self-professed dinosaur in terms of computers, but I think this is, instead of writing hand notes to myself, I'll be on the computer before the hearing putting things in.
And hopefully that answers your question. Add those 29.11 and 12 factors in as an optional section. It just hasn't been added into the app functionality itself yet. We did have a question from Laura Baker-Morish that about which clerk platform integration software has been tested. She asked specifically about CourtView, but if somebody wanted to address that.
Welland County uses CourtView, yeah.
As does Lawrence County. So each of them use Equivant, which is the current name for CourtView. So, but we anticipate that this integration will work with other case management platforms, not just CourtView. Judge Savaggio, I know you had your hand up. Do you still have an additional question?
No, Judge McIntosh actually asked my question as well.
I think the other thing that it's important to frame it, because I'm a dinosaur as well, right? And judges view things in terms of paper because we deal with paper. And I think most courts, in fact, all courts really do this. When you have a sentencing, this is a prison sentence. And depending on the sophistication of your court, you literally have different forms, different pieces of paper, depending on the nature of the sentence. So that what you would do is you would try to find the right form to fit the particular case for which you have to sentence, or your clerk would actually. And then you would try to cobble together, and that's the general current practice. What this does, and I don't think you can appreciate the ease of this, is it eliminates all forms. It creates a web-based system by which you create your own document each time based on the parameters of the case that's before you. So you don't have to, you're not selecting the wrong form anymore, which is how you're eliminating those unforced errors. So long as that form conforms to existing law, and that's the other side to this, which we haven't gotten to, but it's important to understand the role of this commission and Sarah and her staff in the commitment they've made and the request for further funding for additional positions to keep current the use, so that that use document, that application that you just saw, will always have the current version of the law as it relates to the sentencing structure mechanism in Ohio. That's how it will work. That's how it has to work. And knowing that to be successful or accurate, judges who impose felony sentence should take comfort that it's going to get right. It will be done right. It's an aid in your assistance of imposing sentence. So, and I think it's worth pointing that out. Any other questions? If not, the only other thing, and you know, we've taken a fair amount of time, but this is a significant project that the commission staff is undertaking, has undertaken, and will continue to undertake. And I think it's worth some time to make sure that you commission members are fully aware and are given an opportunity to vet or to ask questions as it relates to where we are and where we're headed. You heard Hazem reflect that we've gone to two courts in site visits. We're about to go to Highland County. I'll just rattle off the courts that we have engaged. They have approached us, and we're in the process of scheduling visits with them as well. And in no particular order than how my memory serves, Cuyahoga County has been engaged, and we'll be visiting them late summer, maybe early fall. Franklin County, we're going to come and see Franklin County. Champaign County, Judge Savaggio, we're looking forward to spending a day in your court as well. Hamilton County, we just set up a time there. Summit County, which is really exciting because the entire bench has interested in joining. They're a 10-judge county, and that entire bench is interested in adopting the use and integrating this, and we're looking forward to that. And Wood County up here in Northwest Ohio is another court. So we are happy that we are managing the demands reasonably, I guess is the best way to put it. And that's why we changed the format a little. As once we realized that the technology would work, that the proof of concept would provide the functionality that everyone was desirous in creating both and improving the sentencing mechanism for judges, as well as creating a platform from which data can be collected, then we realize, okay, what can we do given that we know it will work? And that's why we're because this is being grown organically, more and more judges and more courts are interested in having us come to their courts for adoption and potential use. And that's how it's ultimately going to be a success within the state of Ohio, because you're going to have you're going to have an overwhelming number of courts that will want this adoption and will have the use document itself finalized. And then we can make recommendations as to what changes, if any, in various rules or statutes. How do you implement that in a formal way? That's down the road. So that's a brief overview of everything we've done and where we stand and where we're headed. Judge Savaggio, I see you have your hand up.
Thank you. Number one, congratulations to the commission on the rollout. It looks impressive from the use standpoint. I do, and I can't remember what meeting I said this at, so forgive me if I repeat myself. But you know, I do have some caution about judges using this from this standpoint. To our future judges, they may not realize why certain things in the form exist unless they have their hands deep into the creation of the product. And for judges in the future that will be using this product, part of the challenge for the trial judges associations is to educate their judges as to why certain things exist. And it's a lot like the difference between when I was a prosecutor, writing indictments, handwriting them from reading the statute and then writing them and then giving them to the secretary to type up the indictment, versus the advancement in writing an indictment now, which is to use a computer system to click some boxes on the matrix system that they use. And I do fear to some extent that by using this computerized program, it removes the incentive for the removes the incentive as well as removes just the actual practice of judges learning why and how certain sentencing laws are both implemented and integrated. And that doesn't affect any of us today because, you know, we all have our hands knee deep in it. But, you know, judges 15 years down the line that are just checking boxes and, you know, without a real sense of, well, why is this here and what does it mean and that sort of thing, that will be the challenge from the educational point of view. With that said, though, congratulations on a good rollout, and you have unanimity in Champaign County of all the general division judges who are excited to participate. Next on our agenda, Scott Shoemaker with an overview of recent updates. Scott?
Thanks, Judge. I just wanted to kind of start here. I'm going to share my screen. And click the right button here. You should all be seeing just the slideshow at this point. Is that, or just the PowerPoint presentation? Is that working? Okay, great. The commission has conducted a review of the recent Supreme Court jurisprudence. So all the criminal cases since 2017, and we're preparing a document of those cases as sort of a resource for practitioners and reference material. We expect to have that published on our website in the very near future. How it looks laid out is a brief summary of each of the statement of facts and the court's holding in the case, the revised code section, the rule, the constitutional amendment that the case is referencing, and then subsequent actions or recommendations is kind of how we've termed this last section. So it's anything that happened as a result, legislative or otherwise, of the case. And then along with some proposals for potential action by the legislature, along with reference to the Criminal Justice Recodification Committee proposals, Justice Reinvestment 2.0, and things like that. And we wanted to go over those things today as sort of an effort to spark conversation about the work of the commission moving forward and how things might look, how things we might approach changes to the criminal justice system or potential recommended reforms moving forward. These decisions are tracked as part of what we just talked about, the uniform sentencing entry. When the court makes a criminal law decision, commission staff are reviewing that decision to see if it necessitates any changes to the uniform sentencing entry or any of the attendant forms. And then those changes are run past our update protocol work group who review those changes and say, hey, well, I think based upon this decision, we should add this language or we should take this out, make changes to those documents. So they're what Judge Zamuda has referred to several times as a living document. It isn't one snapshot in time. That document will continue to evolve as cases change and statutes change. We want to talk about these things briefly, and we'd really like for this to be a discussion of the group. So if people have something to say, feel free to interrupt me is what I mean to say. Feel free to weigh in, or you don't need to raise your hand. Just go ahead and kind of interrupt me. I don't want this just to be me talking as I go through this brief slideshow, but we've highlighted sort of the central themes that we've seen in those decisions over the last 4 years. Statutory complexity, which I was glad to have Judge Salvaggio and the Chief talk about as the meeting got started. We've got really complicated statutes and procedures in the state. Required advisements at sentencing, at plea, and those are by statute or by rule. And we picked a few decisions that highlight the problems with those cases that do center right around post-release control, as Judge Salvaggio's talked about earlier. And then one of the other themes is the struggle with appellate review of felony sentences. The commission's talked about this for a long time, seeing the Foster decision's effect on 2953-08 and appellate review, the struggle to review extended sentences. We've seen a lot of litigation around that. And that's illustrated by two sets of cases about review of those extended sentences. And then the struggle between new criminal justice statutes or changes in the law and practical application. right? What the system is used to having done, and then when something new is introduced, the sort of balancing act and the struggles that go on there. What you see, and I'm conscious of having the chief here in the room, right? So what you see in these things is the court's role is calling balls and strikes, resolving conflicts amongst the appellate districts and ambiguities. But when you have these kind of complex issues, they look to the legislature for guidance. They're looking to the statute to see what does it actually say. So all of these three things play into one another. They're not all one separate topic, and you'll see how they kind of interplay between each other. You have complex statutes, which lead to an increased need for appellate review of sentences, which leads to new case law and new ways that the system is handling these issues. And so the legislature introduces a new statute, and the court struggles to incorporate that with what the precedent has historically been on the case. So it's not one separate issue. My business associations professor would always say the law is a seamless web. And these things all kind of play into one another. And that's what we try to highlight here. Statutory complexity. So again, this growing list of notifications and advisements. Judge Salvaggio talked about post-release control. There are required indefinite sentencing advisements for recommendation offenses, appeal rights, and those are by statute and by rule. It's not one or the other. Ohio operates under four different sentencing schemes right now. We have definite sentences, we have non-life felony indefinite sentences, we have life sentences subject to parole, and we have capital cases. And that's not even accounting for the pre-SB2 offenders that are still floating around out there who are subject to a different system to the extent those cases are still around. So you have this web of provisions, mandatory versus non-mandatory terms, enhancement specifications. They're often scattered throughout the code. And release is now decided by a judge, by the executive branch through the Department of Rehabilitation and Corrections, or a hybrid model under Senate Bill 201, where you have the executive branch, DRC, making a recommendation on release that goes back to the trial court for the trial court to approve. So again, these things get more and more complicated, and it's the onus is on judges to explain those things. And we see that in post-release control cases. The requirement, State v. Bishop held that courts are required to notify the defendant on post-release control who's committed a new felony, that they could get additional time for that post-release control violation. This is a requirement from Criminal Rule 11. It's not a requirement by statute, but it's a statutory provision that has led to a substantial amount of litigation. And then you look at the Hudson and Harper decisions, which also both dealt with post-release control that was improperly imposed at the time of the plea. Those cases turned on this the kind of void versus voidable discussion as to when those cases can be addressed on appeal. But what they boil down to is we have this incredibly complex set of statutes that are very difficult to understand. And judges have a massive amount of things, and practitioners have a massive amount of things that they have to remember when they're preparing a case for trial, when they're preparing a plea entry for the court, when the case is being sentenced. Did we go through all these things? And errors happen. They happen in these cases, and we understand that, but it leads to a substantial amount of appellate litigation. So that's one of the things, and Judge Zamuda, you can weigh in on this. We think that's one of the things that the use form helps with. Isn't that right? Yes, he's nodding his head, yes. Having the use form there serves as a reference as you're going through the method of conviction form to make sure you have all the boxes checked and things like that. Having the use form there helps make sure that all the necessary language is in the sentencing entry. It reminds the judge that the things that needs to be done on the record. But we keep seeing these cases that illustrate how complex the statutes are. And again, Hudson and Harper play into the appellate review discussion that I talked about as well, because you have this list of cases that have gone on for years litigating, or when can these things be appealed? When can these unforced errors at sentencing be appealed? The other case I'd point to that's not in the entry is State v. Henderson, where the court reviewed an error in the sentencing entry in the defendant's favor that couldn't be corrected down the road. We see these things all the time. And finally, this picture has been floating around. Judge Routson from Hancock County took this photo. Here on the left, you have the revised code from, I believe, just before Senate Bill 2 in 1996. Title 29 was one volume. And now Title 29, and there's some additional things in this, but this is the most recent version of Title 29 here on the right, the black books. We're up to five volumes of the criminal code. So over the 25 years of Senate Bill 2, it's continued to grow. We've continued to see these unforced errors and statutory complexity making things more difficult. And again, that leads to this appellate litigation, right? So the second theme is the kind of appellate review of sentence struggle. Senate Bill 2 was sort of premised around, or one of the central premises, but there would be robust appellate review of felony sentences. Judges were guided towards the minimum terms within the range with necessary findings for higher sentences. We get the Foster decision in 2006. And since then, courts have struggled, and it's one of the things that Judge Gallagher points out to me, to understand what the appellate court's review in the process is. Struggling to understand the definition of contrary to law, again, like those post-release control cases, when and to what extent are these issues reviewable? And how can appellate courts handle 2953.08G2? So that allows an appellate court to resentence from the bench, the appellate bench, when they find a sentence is contrary to law, or there's another one of the other listed errors in that section. And now in a Marcy's Law world, how is that the ability for the appellate court to resentence from the bench impacted? This decision is kind of highlighted in two sets of cases. So we have the Gwynn and the Gwynn decision and the Jones decision that we've talked about before. State v. Gwynn was a case where a 55-year-old woman was given a 65-year sentence for 31 felonies, nonviolent felonies that she pled guilty to, that she appealed to the Ohio Supreme Court based upon, the appeal got to the Ohio Supreme Court based upon a review of the 29, 11, and 12 factors in the sentence. And the court narrowly held that the appellate court couldn't review those factors for the sentence, but remanded that to the 8th District, to the 5th District to look at the consecutive sentence findings instead. So again, it's this struggle to review extended sentences when it gets to the appellate court, and the appellate court struggle to understand what their role in that is and what contrary to law means. And then later later in 2020, you saw State v. Jones, which was a one count case that asked to have those same 29, 11, 12 factors reviewed. And the court held that is not something that's considerable as contrary to law. We still don't have a great idea of what contrary to law means, whether it's contrary to statute, whether it's contrary to rule. It's difficult to understand. So again, it's the courts struggling to understand their role. And what it leads to is again, increased litigation. So State v. Gwynn's gone back to its district for reconsideration, and now it's got an Eighth Amendment argument attached to it. And why does it have an Eighth Amendment argument attached to it? Because of the next two cases that we're going to talk about. State v. McFarland was an appeal of a discretionary imposition of life without parole. So that's the LWOP in there, based upon a sufficiency of the evidence argument. So McFarland was sentenced to life without parole for her involvement in conspiracy to commit a homicide offense in Cuyahoga County. 2953.08D3 prohibits the appeal of aggravated murder and murder charges. And the reason behind that is that when Senate Bill 2 passed in 1996, there's only one penalty for aggravated murder, non-capital, non-sexually oriented aggravated murder and murder. You could only get 15 to life for murder. You could only get 20 to life for aggravated murder, absent a sexual motivation or a capital specification on that case. That law was changed in 125 GA House Bill 184 and allowed multiple penalties to be imposed for aggravated murder. Now you could get 20 to life, 25 to life, 30 to life, or life without parole for an aggravated murder charge at the discretion of the sentencing court judge, who's in the best position to make that determination. However, the appellate review statute wasn't changed to reflect that there's a discretionary imposition of life without parole. So McFarland is left to challenge the fact that she was sentenced to die in prison under a sufficiency of the evidence argument, attacking the actual conviction itself. And the court's hands are tied in that, in how they're going to be able to review it, just based upon the sufficiency of the evidence argument. You have to contrast that case with State versus Patrick, which came out later the same year, which dealt with a juvenile who was convicted of a homicide offense and sentenced to 33 years to life in prison for aggravated murder they committed when they were 17, where the court held that failure to consider the youth of the individual meant that sentence was cruel and unusual under the Eighth Amendment to the Constitution. So you have, contrasting these two cases, you see that the struggle that appellate courts have in reviewing them. They can't review a murder case based upon that, but you do see them able to review things under Eighth Amendment cases and struggling to understand that as well. And it's a different standard that applies based upon the nature of the defendant, which isn't unusual. But again, it adds to that statutory complexity and confusion. Tim, I think when you see a juvenile, Tim Young, I wanted to try to kick this question to you. When you see a juvenile who's able to successfully challenge a sentence on Eighth Amendment concerns, do you see that extended in the future? I mean, will your office be making arguments on whether that should extend up to age 25, whether that should apply to people with intellectual disability or a serious mental illness?
Of course, because the rationale is the same. The brain science we have says everything about under 18 actually extends to almost 25 in terms of decision making. And obviously for any type of permanent disability, that same argument would apply. And of course, we'll be bringing those.
And Judge Gallagher, what's your feeling on the kind of Eighth Amendment approach to challenging these cases? Got to unmute himself, maybe.
Sorry. I understood why the court felt they had to do what they had to do in Patrick, because there really wasn't any other relief out there. But I think, you know, Mr. Young and I probably don't agree on this, but I think if we're going to start extending constitutional challenges to sentencing now, we're going to really open up Pandora's box. Everything's going to be a constitutional violation.
But and that'll vary between districts as well, right? What one district thinks is a constitutional violation might not be the same for another district. And we're going to get back to the same place we are with contrary to law, where the Eighth Amendment thinks these cases are contrary to law. And another district might not.
I think you have to read one will have to understand the extent to which Jones constrains that. Okay. Cause I think the rationale of the Jones decision could have application in this effort to expand the appeal based on constitutional grounds. Attorneys, judges would be wise to try and figure out how Jones applies going forward to just how expansive it is to appeal when it's not contrary to a specific statute, the current structure methodology itself.
Yeah, and there will always be, and my point in this isn't that there's any one good answer, right? There will always be these issues with any statute that might come in. There will always be interpretation issues and variances between the courts. It's great. It keeps all us lawyers in jobs, right? And debating these cases. But we're at a place in the state of Ohio, and our point in pointing these things out was where we continue to have these debates and sort of tinker around the edges of changes with a system that's got these all the things involved in these central themes going on. So we wanted to kick this idea to the commission to see what they think the work of the commission on this kind of issues going forward might be. The one thing I'd note about State versus Patrick is how it plays back into the interplay between these three themes again, right? So the court's deciding this issue on extended sentences for juvenile bindover offenders at the exact same time, I think within days of the decision being issued in Patrick, the General Assembly passes Senate Bill 256. And what Senate Bill 256 does is, and it goes into effect here on April 12th, it institutes a ban on life without parole for juvenile offenders, gives judges, just like the court said in its decision, it gives judges specific factors that they need to consider when sentencing a youth in their court. And then it changes parole eligibility for juveniles who have received extended sentences in the past and those who will receive extended sentences in the future. So in the Patrick case, you have an individual who received a sentence of 33 years to life after there were a number of issues that went into his case, but he ends up with a sentence of 33 years to life by the court. It's been remanded for resentencing, but assuming that 33-year sentence holds up, Patrick will actually be eligible for parole after 25 years now. So regardless of what the court says in its sentencing, Patrick will be eligible for parole in 25 years. Because of the tenets of Senate Bill 256. Again, that plays into how these things all work together, right? Because now you've got the legislature implementing a new statute that has fundamentally altered how the practices work and made things, again, more complex. We have a judge can tell a juvenile, I'm going to give you 33 years to life, but actually you're going to be eligible for parole in 25 years based on the nature of your offenses, or 18 years based on the nature of your offenses, or 30 years based on the nature of your offenses. The legislature stepped in, altered practice, altered historical practice in these cases, changed the sentencing structure again, and there are good goals behind that, right? They obviously, from the court's decision, and the legislature's bill, they want the same thing. They want courts to be considering the youth of an offender when they're sentencing the case. But we've made things more complex and more difficult for trial court judges again, and we're then forced into this position to balance those cases. And another sort of topic, this theme is sort of presented in the discussion around technical violations of community control, which the commission has talked about quite a bit. One of those things that was presented without a definition. So it falls upon the courts to interpret what the statute means in the absence of a definition of technical violation. And one of the other problems with new statutes is that they don't always consider collateral effect on other provisions, right? So you have a technical violation that says you can only go to prison for 90 or 180 days, but doesn't address how that works if you're in a TCAP county, where that prison term has to be served in local jail. You see that a lot in new statutes that causes the statutes to become more complex, leads to appellate litigation, which then generates case law that makes it harder to adapt to new cases. So it really highlights the need for clear and concise statutory language and a recognition that statutes still need to be flexible and respond to these things. And just briefly talking about these technical violation cases. We had a couple cases from the court this year where the court stepped in to provide a standard in defining the undefined technical violation, right? Where they said, you know, it's basically a totality of the circumstances analysis to determine, is this violation technical in nature based upon the judge's goals in placing the person on the community control and how the violation related to those overall goals. The way to boil down the Nelson and the Kastner case. As these cases are being litigated in front of the Ohio Supreme Court, there is a pending definition in the legislature of technical violation. So the court announces a standard in 2020 for courts to use when they're evaluating technical violations. And then the legislature steps in and takes effect on April 12th with this definition of technical violation. Which there is room in here for an analysis as the court described in Nelson and Kastner. But the problem with this is they gave us a definition that says what a technical violation isn't and not what a technical violation is. This is defined in the negative. So it is something to which neither of these apply. And one is that it's a new criminal offense, not does criminal offense mean conviction or does criminal offense mean offense? Does it have to be proven or not? And then it says that consists of an articulated or demonstrated refusal to participate, and the refusal demonstrates that they've abandoned the objects of community control. So those terms are undefined. What does that mean for courts? They'll have to go back to that Nelson versus Kastner analysis. And that's, again, the role of the courts and the legislature together, but it's a further example of this struggle to interpret new statutes and historical precedent highlighted again by the fact that now these technical violations, when the offender is released from their 90 or 180 day sentence at the prison, they must return to community control in front of the court that sentenced them to the extent that they have time remaining on their community control sanctions. So up to 5 years that they can be supervised, to the extent they have time left, they must return from prison and be back on community control. And this is in pretty direct contravention to what the court has historically held, which is that you can only receive prison or probation as a sentence on a single count, one or the other, not both. So again, we're seeing this statutes that will be struggled to interpret in the face of historical precedent. We have a prohibition on this kind of split sentence. And the last point I'll make on this, and then open it up to more discussion, is this rinse and repeat provision is kind of how we've been referring to it, because it can happen more than once. You could get sentenced on a technical violation more than one time, go back on community control, and then technically violate again to the extent you have time left on your supervision. The mandatory return to community control only applies to felonies of the fourth and fifth degree. But if you're on community control for a felony of the second degree, say, the judge could send you to prison for 2 years and then return you to community control. And it's a different standard based upon the level of the offense. So again, we're seeing this very different approach, again, that had noble motivations behind it. There's a perceived need on the part of the legislature that they want to try to address that maybe doesn't understand how things work in the real world, and it's because we continue to tinker around the edges of the sentencing system. So with that, I'm happy to open it up. I know it's hard and over Zoom to kind of not want to talk over people as well, but we really did want this to be a discussion. Just a nice picture of the court there at the end. But we really did want this to be a discussion amongst the members about how the work of the commission might work going forward. So I'll open that up to all of you.
Scott, I'll start it off. With regard to your last slide, which causes some concern, what incentive would a judge have to want to violate somebody for a technical violation on a single F4 or F5? And I ask this more rhetorically. You know, under what scenario would we want to essentially say it's a technical violation, we've given up on trying to rehabilitate you, so we're going to send you to prison for 90 days only to have you then come back and be required to be on community control again? And I mean, it just makes no sense whatsoever.
When the point of putting someone on community control was to make sure they didn't get a prison number, to some extent, or in a lot of cases.
Well, I think what you're going to, I think what we may see is judges waiting for that person, you know, telling the probation department, look, don't bring me a technical violation unless there's some new criminal offense that we can make it a technical violation. Otherwise, we're just spinning our wheels. I mean, that's the way I look at it. Anyone have any thoughts? Sean?
Yeah, I guess I want to borrow a phrase from Father O'Brien, who was my little pastor back in the 1960s when I was a kid. And, you know, it was like perpetual devotion, I guess. I'm shocked that the judiciary, we've taken on this role now of, well, I call it perpetual probation. It's like judges are managing the lives of individuals for an ongoing basis. You know, I don't know what happened to the days of, look, you were put on probation, you violated, you went to jail, and that was it. We moved on, you know. So if the goal is to keep felony four and felony five offenders out of the state prison system, then just impose the 180-day and 90-day caps across the board and get rid of this nonsense, technical, non-technical. I still am waiting to see somebody actually show me an offender who's a technical violator. All these people violate with, you know, positive drug tests, not showing up, not going to treatment, not paying their fines, not, you know, I mean, it's ridiculous the level that we've reached in Ohio. I mean, so I guess you guys have heard me spout about this forever and a day, and I guess I shouldn't do it here, but it's just very frustrating that we're now turning, I don't know, judges into parish priests.
Others?
That reflects that addiction shouldn't be in our criminal justice system, that it's not well served, and we just don't have the right answers. That's what 90-day sentences do. They just simply isolate somebody and then you bring them back. Unless we're going to devote ourselves to treatment as the answer, this is going to continue to be a discussion this decade, next decade, as long as we continue using a criminal justice system for an addiction issue.
Others?
Judge, one of the things, I guess, not seeing it, you know, other people wanting to step in, I would note that definition of technical violation comes as a part of House Bill 1, which was passed at the in lame duck of the General Assembly there, and goes into effect on April 12th, I apologize. Part of the provisions of that bill is that the commission itself is, you know, told to study the effects of House Bill 1 and the changes therein. So these things around technical violations lead into our next discussion, is just like all those issues played into each other, they lead into our next discussion, which is the HB 1 study group that Laura is going to talk about.
Morning, everybody. I believe I'm off mute. Thank you, Scott, for the introduction. The House Bill 1 Implementation Study Group. As Scott just said, this was passed in late December of 2020, goes into effect April 12th. One of the things that House Bill 1 did is it expanded the role of the Criminal Sentencing Commission, but it also specifically tasked the commission with understanding and providing a report upon the impact of the implementation of House Bill 1. As I said, it doesn't start until April 12th, but the commission has already gotten to work on establishing a committee. Sarah sent out a series of invites to everybody on the commission, and I believe a number of other related individuals to get everybody that we needed on the committee to establish this implementation assessment so that we could prepare this report as required by statute. We met for the first time in late February, and we have a plan in place to meet over the next coming months. We've broken down the work that we're going to be doing by topic that's covered within the bill, and I'm going to go over that just briefly. Specifically, what the commission has been asked to do, and then the committee subsequently has been asked to do as part of the commission, is to study the impact of House Bill 1, but that impact was not defined within House Bill 1 itself. So the first goal of the committee is to try and determine what it means to be impacted by House Bill 1, what data is available, what are the categories that have been impact of criminal justice reform that have been impacted by House Bill 1, and how can we potentially measure those. So just to go over briefly what House Bill 1 includes, we're looking at what we've been calling a number of buckets, as it were, categories of impact that House Bill 1 has played into. The first one I'm going to talk about is record sealing, only because that is going to be our March meeting. So as I indicated, we've broken this down into monthly meetings of the committee. We would ask anybody who has an interest in seeing this go forward to please take a look at the website. You can see our agenda laying out how we're going to be dealing with the different categories. And if you do work in that specific area of law, we would absolutely welcome your input. In March, as I said, end of this month, we're going to be looking at record sealing. Specifically, what House Bill 1 did in relationship to record sealing is it broadened the application of the conviction record sealing law by removing the cap. The cap previously it existed on total felony convictions, eligibility of fourth and fifth degree felony and misdemeanor offenses, and raising the cap on restricted felony and misdemeanor offenses. Also modified the period of time which an individual has to apply for record sealing for those particular broadened categories of offenses. And then the last thing it did was more of an administrative thing. It lessened the amount of fees that would be going to BCI to use for purposes of engaging in record sealing work, but it also at the same time streamlined the process for getting that money to BCI. So one of the things this committee will be looking at is whether or not that streamlining has in fact resulted in more money to getting to BCI on time in order to then effectuate their role in all of this. In terms of record sealing itself, the committee, as I said, will be meeting to discuss what kind of records are available. We recognize that this is going to be a challenging area because while BCI would ultimately receive records of, well, they would receive records of conviction and then they would see records of sealing from the court. What we don't believe we have a full sense for is how many individuals are actually eligible for record sealing and how we can potentially count those numbers or quantify those numbers in any particular way. Again, because we're lacking in a unified court system, it's very difficult to kind of take a look to determine if an individual, because of their whole life experiences, are or are not eligible for record sealing. So that's problem number one. Problem number two is that there's a lack of a really great database for determining how many people have actually applied versus how many people have been granted record sealing. So again, there are some issues that we're gonna have to face as the committee about what kind of data is available and what kind of recommendations we might be making back about how to make sure that we're better accumulating that information so we can actually assess these things. So that's kind of bucket number one, record sealing. Number two is intervention in lieu. Generally speaking, again, it both broadens and narrows those eligible for intervention in lieu. It makes it for a larger group of individuals generally that might be eligible for consideration for intervention, but it also specifically removes individuals involving sexually related offenses. So we'll be looking at intervention in lieu in the month of April. The next large bucket is the one that we were just discussing, and that of course is the prison time and technical violations for those who are subject to a community control sanction violation. We will be looking at that, I believe, in June, if I'm right, Sarah. I think I skipped the month of May, but that will be the month of June. Again, in terms of the data collection and how to determine the impact of House Bill 1, one of the difficulties in this area, not only the information that Scott has just shared regarding what constitutes a technical violation, how those particular violations are sanctioned or not sanctioned, where is the data collected for all of this, but then also how can we tell whether or not any particular case was a result of House Bill 1? How are we going to show that the changes made in House Bill 1 were the thing that resulted in this particular sentence or this particular sanction being handled in this particular way? So that's one of the challenges with that particular category. And then the last one, and I saved this to last, even though it's going to be the May topic of conversation, is the impact upon probate court for involuntary court-ordered treatment of alcohol or drug abuse. This is kind of different from the other three. Obviously, it's related in many ways. A number of individuals who are criminal justice involved are obviously also dealing with alcohol and or drug abuse issues, but it's not specifically tied to any criminal violation. So it's kind of an odd thing to be addressing at the same time. And so I'm really helpful. If anybody who works in probate, please come to our committee. We have some, and I'm really grateful for their work, but anybody else, we could use that. But also, just recently, just this morning, Sarah let me know that there's been an amendment to Senate Bill 2, which is Senator Gavarone's bill addressing mental health competency issues, which are criminal justice related, but that particular amendment that was offered by Seitzen that was accepted to Senate Bill 2 relates also back to the House Bill 1 that was passed last year regarding the availability of involuntary commitment following a probate hearing related to drug or alcohol substance abuse on an emergency basis. So that's also going to impact the committee's work in terms of what we ought to be studying. Will Senate Bill 2 ultimately pass or not pass during the relevant period of time that we're beginning the study for implementation? Because currently, it goes into effect in April, as Scott mentioned. The last thing that came about as a part of House Bill 1 that we're still kind of trying to figure out how best to study the impact of is the separate provisions that were relating to the prohibition against restraints against pregnant delinquent children or pregnant female offenders. It seems an odd connection, those particular violations or particular restrictions in being included in House Bill 1, which was otherwise a kind of criminal justice reform pertaining predominantly to sentencing and conviction, whereas this is more about restraint at various points in time throughout criminal justice involvement. We have not yet, I don't believe, come to fully a conclusion about how best to study its impact. It's not the kind of thing that's typically tracked. There is also some confusion in the language itself regarding what constitutes an arrest. Is it only if it's being an arrest on a warrant? Does it also relate to warrantless arrests? It doesn't specifically address that. Is detention part of arrest? What is it, law enforcement? There's a lot of questions. So that is something that also that the committee has been tasked with. As I said, we will have subject-related monthly meetings that, as broken down, as I just stated, we'll be working with staff from the Sentencing Commission about the data gathering, collection, and analysis. I'm going to turn it over to anybody who would like to then jump in and talk a little bit about what that is going to entail. But the end goal is a draft sometime in the fall, finalization of that draft, and then presentation as required by the statute in December. This is also an ongoing obligation on the part of the Sentencing Commission. This is just the first such report that's required by statute. Any questions? Or I turn it over to Sarah and staff. Nikki, did you want to add anything to any of the? Okay.
Thanks, Laura. I think you did a great job. I mean, you covered it all. And if you have any questions, just let us know. As Laura said, our next meeting is next week, so that'll be the second meeting of the group. And we're happy to take your input, and we'll keep the commission posted along the way. It looks like we have a question for Laura, so from Dave Foreman. Can you unmute him or whatever you have, what magic happens to let people talk?
Dave, you should be able to talk.
All right. Thank you so much for the minute here. Hey, Laura, real quick. You said these monthly meetings, I got the ILC was scheduled for April. What month did you say the probate court for the mandatory treatment on alcohol and AOD and what month for the mental health competency issues? I missed those months.
So the month of May for the probate related, and the mental health competency is actually a separate bill. But there are provisions being added to that bill that's currently in the General Assembly that might impact the May topic relating to the probate court and the ability or the allowance for mandatory hospitalization following a probate order. So that's all the month of May.
Okay, and are those open just for the committee or for any other parties interested?
No, we'd be happy to have your participation, Dave. I'll include you on the distribution once we select the date.
Fantastic. Yep. Thank you, Sarah. Thank you, Laura.
Sure. I think Judge Spanagle has a question as well.
I don't have a question. I just had to go on the bench for a bit.
Oh.
I thought I saw your hand raised, but actually that's my cursor. Never mind. Sorry, hey, Judge.
I got my black dress on.
Good to see your face, Judge Spanagel.
I don't know why.
Well, like I said, we welcome anybody else who wants to participate in the committee. We're very interested in the feedback from the committee and guidance in terms of what the impact might be of these changes and how to measure that impact going forward.
All right, thanks, Laura. I think that completes our agenda items for the day. Thank you to Sarah, Scott, and staff for organizing the presentations. I actually thought it was a solid meeting, a lot of meat there to digest.
Don't our sound next so surprised is, by that.
What's that?
Don't sound so surprised, like, ooh.
I wasn't surprised, I was pleasantly surprised.
Okay, good, thank you.
Using my adjectives. Our next meeting is June 24th. I am aware that the Common Pleas judges, I also think, have at least scheduled seminar, not in person, but I think by Zoom as well. So there may be some conflict for some of the members.
Okay, well, we picked the 24th because I understood the Common Pleas judges meeting to be the week prior.
Oh, it is? All right.
I think, because we're not the third Thursday in June for that reason, but I'll confirm.
All right, you know, ever since Zamuda and Donnelly left, we've been in disarray. So with that being said, then, can I have a motion to adjourn?
So moved, Spanagel.
All right, we'll see you guys later.
Nice to see everyone. Take care.